Eugene. Recorded live.
Hello, everybody. And it is, I believe, what's the date? Monday, the 26th. I'm going to get there in a minute. 26th of April. I want to welcome everybody to the call today. And we've got several questions here. The first one looks like fun, disassociation. My husband and I have been talking about how he felt every time he masturbated while watching porn, had cyber sex, or sex with his affair partner. He says that he does not remember much and that he does not remember lust. He says he always felt he was a third party watching, totally numb. He noticed that his triggers are not seeing a pretty woman. It's when something happens to Kim that makes him feel depressed, lonely, feeling lost, drained, no energy to do tasks, or after he plays a concert and feels good, he drops into depression. Actually, that would be more of a crash off of adrenaline. He says even the concert playing gave the same blank, numb feelings. He says he does not remember when he plays and feels like it's a blank screen. Same with acting out. I just met Mark Laser at a women's retreat. My husband is going in 2 weeks. He said that this is disassociation. He originally stated that playing guitar to protect himself, he really started playing the guitar and to protect himself and suppress bad feelings. He said the acting out felt like it was to suppress his bad feelings. He said he did not feel pressure during acting out, and he always sees himself outside from behind himself. He can't see his face. Is it possible to not feel lust or have lust as a trigger? It seems possible. Mark says it sounded like he has severe childhood trauma. He was emotionally abandoned by his mother or father. The impact, mostly his mother, emotional abandonment. He was also physically and verbally abused by her starting at age 5. He said that when she beat him, he also felt like same out of body, same way of acting out. Same, he saw himself as if he were standing behind himself. Is it possible he has trauma that he doesn't remember? Mark also said usually these descriptions are from sexually abused children. And yeah, I would actually second everything that Mark just talked about. There is a condition called disassociation, and it is a defense mechanism actually utilized by certain individuals, and that they go through severe trauma. If I remember right, about 10% of the population actually uses disassociation as a coping mechanism. But certainly people who have severe abuse frequently will utilize disassociation. So this is a strong possibility in the type of circumstance that you're describing. Now, one of the things you also asked there is about lust. With trauma, you get into what's called a trauma bond, and this is far more complicated than we have right now. But oftentimes, it's not a lust-based sort of thing, or a lust as you would think of lust. It's a desire to recreate abusive situations. So in one way or the other. So when you're dealing with disassociation, it certainly kind of carries a little bit different feel for the person, at least maybe potentially the motivations of what are triggers and what drives it. And that's why, you know, I say on these calls over and over again, that it's really difficult to say a one-size-fits-all. There are so many different types of are reasons that people act out. Not everything is sexual addiction. Not everything is, you know, someone falling in love. It's so varied that it's difficult. So we can answer that one question, and I can say, yes, that sounds like disassociation, and overall disassociation is a defense mechanism, or someone actually, it's not really fully them. They withdraw emotionally, so they're very blank and they're very numb in the situation. The disassociation can be almost amnesic, where they don't even remember the circumstance. That's severe disassociation, where they completely check out of the entire scene. Disassociation and addiction. My husband wants to ask if disassociation is linked to addiction. Do they go hand in hand? If so, what kind of results should he expect from abstinence? We're doing 40 days sobriety from acting out. He's been sober since January 2010. The 12-step program in therapy. How's he supposed to heal from trauma? Oh, what if he has suppressed trauma that he's not aware of? How does that get unlocked? He's realized he's never been in touch with his negative feelings because he's always been suppressing them. He has been, but has always suppressed, never intervened with them. So at one level, when you're dealing with what we're referring to here as disassociation, and there are lots of addicts who have disassociation, and I don't know that that makes them any less addicted to something. It's an interesting component, or at least it doesn't make the behavior any less compulsive. Now, whether or not she uses addiction, you'd have to almost go. It gets more complicated because you're dealing with two separate issues, disassociation and potentially an addictive behavior. It depends on which one is primary. That would have to be diagnosed by a psychologist or a really good therapist who's worked with disassociation and also worked with addiction. It potentially, though, could set part of an additional piece of treatment that someone like that would need to have, because you've got to also address the trauma wound or the trauma bond that's creating the impetus for that behavior. So ways that you typically treat trauma, depending on if they've got PTSD, one way that you might use potentially is EMDR. There are several really good programs to address issues of childhood sexual abuse, and oftentimes kind of changing the – going back through and kind of healing those memories. Group work is often used in a different type of group work. It's frequently used with disassociation versus addiction. It's not like you can say that necessarily if you clear up the addiction that you stop the disassociation, or if you stop the disassociation, you clear up the addiction. Obviously, they play off each other, but, you know, again, it's too complicated without talking to them, but there's really a good chance they're both standalone. And so it really becomes kind of two sets of issues that need to be utilized. I think, you know, the fact that he is now currently going through treatment for the addiction and that he's really beginning to experience sobriety is a really good sign. And I would allow, you know, I certainly would, you know, stopping the sexual acting out to me would kind of be the first and the primary goal. The disassociation would end up being a secondary goal. So hopefully that would, you know, you would want to kind of start with, to me, you know, what puts the marriage most at risk and what puts him most at risk and what puts you most at risk, and that's the addictive behaviors. The trauma, which may be at the root of that, that would be kind of the next thing you would go for, just because if that's kind of a root issue, I always say you want to kill the spider, not just sweep spider webs. And so that would be certainly you want to get down to what is at the root of that and help him heal from that so that he can be present and begin to experience some of those emotions. I don't remember in a long time anybody asking questions on disassociation, so this is interesting having these questions. I just discovered that I have a love addiction. I'm the hurt spouse, and my husband has a sexual addiction. We also realized that we are codependent. I'm supposed to act surprised. He's the victim, and I'm the grand savior, a grandiose savior, too involved in his life, so that I can't have my own life or feel my feelings. I'm scared. We're both really messed up. We have a six-month-old baby, and we want to break the cycle. We've realized that my grandfather had a sexual addiction also, and I'm suspecting my father does as well. This is really getting big. I don't want our baby to end up like us. My love limerence addiction is currently to my husband. I left my first husband for him. I have never loved in a healthy way. I was responsible for my father's feelings as a child. I could never show sadness or my own needs. I know my issues start here, and I've transferred and have transferred to men in my life. Good grief. Is there help for both of us? Do I need a 12-step program too? I also feel now that I have no right to feel hurt by my husband's betrayal. I'm as bad as him. I was unfaithful in my first marriage. I should understand and have empathy. Okay. It's very, very, very common for someone who is married to an addict to also be what we call a co-addict. That's why there are things called COSA, S-Anon. For alcoholics, we have Al-Anon. So the love addictions, however, can go beyond just kind of a co-addiction. It can be its own freestanding. And absolutely, if you're – I mean, I always recommend groups anyway. But the love addiction is an important one to address. So, and there's some good programs. PM Melody has a book, I believe, on love addiction, if I remember correctly. And I've got it. It's on intimacy. It's not false intimacy. The Intimacy Factor, I think, may be the name of it. And it kind of addresses this a little bit. I would also look at Codependent No More, if you haven't read anything by Pia Melody. The love addiction really is just kind of a counterpart to the sexual addiction. Many people would actually say that love addiction and sexual addiction are very, very tightly, or they're all that's different is the addictive object. They both kind of deal with a relational intimacy issue or a lack thereof. Marnie Feree, F-R-E-E-E-R, I think that's right. Her book, No Stones, and Marnie's a good friend of mine. I love Marnie's book, No Stones, and it is on female sexual addiction, but it covers love addiction pretty thoroughly. So it would be a really good read for you to look at. I think you'll find that it probably addresses most of the issues, and it would suggest that you want to be ultimately in a women's group. The problem with the love addiction is, again, it's not really – it impairs your ability to actually love your mate because in that sort of situation, you're still using your mate ultimately to make you feel good, which is why you would become so desperate if you feel that he's pulling away from you, because ultimately he's kind of your drug of choice. And so it's difficult to begin to – or to be able to act in the best interest of your mate if you're so kind of consumed at one point with making sure that, you know, you're getting your own needs met through the relationship. Frequently, those type of relationships, and Al Ells refers to this, they're one-way relationships where it feels like you do the vast majority of the giving and get very little back. But the problem, again, with the love addict is we love in order to get something back. We give in order to receive. We do in order to give. It's you know, it's one way. It's almost like there's this insatiable appetite that we need back from the other person, and so we continue to love and love and love more. We have this incredible, you know, attachment to this other person, and then we're blown away when they don't respond to us or that they go out and do things that are really hurtful to us or inconsiderate, or if they're a sex addict, of course, that's a huge betrayal for the love addict. And the amount of pain and trauma that is created for the love addict is just unbelievable. It's even in some ways a little bit different because it's almost like I'm losing my drug, I'm losing my fix, I'm losing the way that I stay centered in life, the way that I cope with life. And so it's even a little bit more disoriented. So the fact that you're seeing it, I think, is amazing. Congratulations. Not that you've got that, but that you're willing to address it. And again, Marty Free's book would be a really good book. No Stones or Pia Melody's book to begin to kind of get your mind around it. And then then definitely 12-step programs would be in line. I know that we're actually doing a course right now for females who have love addictions, and that will actually be available for people, I think, in the online version pretty soon. But there's got to be some things in your area. Oh, one other thing that you might look at, now that I'm just kind of talking here, that would be the St. Augustine Fellowship or SL, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. A lot of times, if I have women involved with love addiction, I'll have them do SLAA. And I don't know if you have an SLAA group in your area, Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous, but that would also be a group that would probably fit very well for you if you can find one. It just depends on if there's one in your particular area. And hopefully, and one more thing, you still have a right to your feelings about what your husband done. It's not that there's not a trauma bond. But, you know, I think that when we begin to look at ourselves and we can do our own inventory and see where, you know, it becomes also about, I see me through the whole process, I do become a lot less moralistic and judgmental. But it doesn't change the fact that you're really, you know, deeply hurt by what your husband did. So don't tell yourself you don't have a right to the feelings, but I think maybe there's more balance that you'll experience at this point than you did prior, just regarding those feelings. So are you online? Did I answer your question there?
Yes, thank you.
Okay, well, I hope that helps a little bit. And I love Marnie's books. I said that. Thank you. I would find that to be really helpful. And The Intimacy Factor by Pia Melody or Codependent No More and SLAA.
It makes sense about it.
I'm sorry, what?
It makes sense about it feeling like it's more of a trail since sex is so integrated into me feeling like who I am and how I have power.
Right. Well, you end up almost more with a like a heroin addict withdrawing from heroin. So I'm not trying to minimize the rift in a person's identity that comes ultimately from betrayal. But for the love addict, there's another element with that limerence, because with limerence, you know, typically that person will be focused on the limerent object, or for you that, and right now it'd be your husband. You probably think about him 75 to 80% of the day anyway. That was before, if you're really in limerence, before this ever happened, because you didn't have a life. I mean, that's the problem with any addict. Our addictions cost us our life. I mean, all we can focus on is the addiction. And so, you know, it even becomes more a sense of life because there never was a sense of balance to even begin with. And so it's even more disorienting, I think, in cases like that. Anger and sexual addiction. In my husband's workbook by Mark Laser, I love Mark, by the way. He is a good guy. I'm glad you got to meet him. I'll be with Mark speaking in July, actually, at Smart Marriages Conference in Orlando. Sexual integrity is a fallen world. he did his exercise on anger and realized that even though typically people use one of the following dysfunctional methods, he uses all six: stuff it, delay it, displace it, minimize it, numb it, and avoid it. What could it mean if he uses all six? You know, my first thought is it means he's darn creative. And I do know people that use more than just one. I think it's important that he's aware of it, and maybe you tackle kind of one at a time. I know when I was doing some of my work on anger management, I kind of went after one at a time just because to try to deal with all six at once was kind of hard. But, I mean, I just think that's part of our growing up. I mean, I want to slowly begin to address the issues that are in my heart, my hardest part, my really the whole dysfunctional way that I approach life. Hopefully a sponsor, if he's involved with a sponsor, can really help set some of that stuff up for him and should be able to help that be better for him. But yeah, I'd say that, you know, he's a lucky guy to be that creative. I mean, it's more to deal with. You know, it's just, that's kind of what it is. And disassociation, and maybe if he's the one that you're talking about with disassociation, that that has a little bit to do with the disassociation in addition. Let's see. I'm sorry, what?
That is him.
Okay, yeah. So then I would say that has a lot to do with potentially with the disassociation, which would be why. Because if you think about those particular things and disassociation, they're not going to address things. It's going to be very much about a complete avoidance. And the disassociation, you could actually add disassociate to that list. It's just that Mark didn't have it in there because most people don't have that one. I'm sorry, what?
I think there was, he asked, my husband had some question underneath that one. I think you skipped
it. Okay.
Sorry.
Okay, recovery for sexual addiction. How important is it for the sexual addict to understand what he was feeling at the moment of acting out versus working on recovery to avoid relapse? Is it relevant for the addict to uncover his feelings during the acting out? Is disassociation with all the acting out, his memories are numb, are feeling numb, and memories and memory loss? He says that he tries to remember. It's like looking through a spyglass, through a peephole in the door. Is this how all sexual addicts feel? From what we read, they speak a lot of lust, excitement, enjoyment, pleasure. He only kind of felt the psychological pleasure of sex, but it wasn't enjoyable. He had severe childhood trauma that he lives with every day. Absolutely, I don't think it's important to be able to get down to those feelings. To me, about 99% right now needs to be focused on avoiding relapse and doing recovery work to that end. A lot of times with addictions, we think that if we can understand the why, that somehow it's going to help with recovery. And addiction, if you're dealing specifically with addiction, addiction is the one thing that it is shown is insight and kind of understanding and seeing those things and experiencing those things has almost no efficacy in helping the person get beyond the addiction. Working with the recovery work, doing the 12 steps, focusing on your own moral inventories, focusing far more on being able to be rigorously honest in the present moment, staying present, actually, in dealing with life on life's terms, sitting there considering how I'm impacting other people. Recovery is very much about being present in the moment. What you're describing with disassociation is something where you're not even able to be present in the moment when you're acting out. even though most addicts aren't even truly present in the moment, you know, they're not in reality. They're living in some sort of crazy fantasy. We all have rituals in the ways that we act out. I remember one of my clients, when we began looking at his rituals, he would pick up prostitutes. And the first thing he would do when he met a prostitute is he'd hold his fingers over his lip and he would tell her not to speak and to be quiet because he didn't want to hear her voice. And I remember when we were going through it, I said, why do you always shush, you know, the women before, you know, something happens? I mean, what are you doing? And he said, well, it's because the second I hear their voice, the allure, they can't be the fantasy woman anymore once they actually have a voice. And so, you know, I think that for a lot of people when they're acting out, they're not really dealing in reality, even though with someone who's using disassociation, they're dealing even less in reality. Therefore, I think it's very important for them in that process to just kind of learn, how do I, you know, just in this day, in the recovery process, I mean, in this day, how do I learn to be present and experience what's going on? I mean, at that point, at least I'm now living life on life's terms. I'm now trying to face reality. And when someone learns to do that, and kind of stays in community and accepts what their weaknesses are, they're able to do much better about not acting out. So, like I said, you're going to definitely want to stick with, I think, the recovery work, not trying to figure out as you look through the keyhole, you know, what was I feeling there, because that's almost going to be irrelevant in the long run. Hope that helps a little bit. Let's see, I just lost the next question. I was trying to refresh here. Give me just a second. My little computer is working. Did that answer that call well enough or that question well enough? While I'm pulling this thing back up again?
We're trying to understand the difference between fantasy and disassociation.
Say the last part. You're trying to understand the relationship between what now?
No, the difference between, you said most addicts act out of fantasy or disassociation, and so he's trying to think if he was acting out of fantasy, but he's not really sure what it means.
Yeah, I don't know that, again, that it would probably make a huge difference. I know that the probably just being able to do recovery work in stay focused in the moment is going to be the more important part. And he'll figure out, I mean, that's really, to me, more of a piece of his individual work. And in the short run, I would just as soon people be focused on learning to live well as trying to go back and spend a lot of time looking into the cesspool. I just want to make sure that they get free initially. And so they, you know, a large amount of focus needs to be there on healing the relationship if possible, or at least becoming who I need to be in the moment. And as time allows and there's space, you go back and look at the other. The problem with doing inventories, and it's, you know, that's why the fourth step can be a very, very difficult piece. And a lot of people relapse on the fourth step because going back triggers them a lot. And so that's why you need a really good sponsor. So I usually recommend, unless somebody's working with their sponsor or with the therapist, that they don't need to be spending a lot of time back at their whole acting out piece, because it's too likely, I think, to cause problems and get the kind of reactivate the system. So just learning to live life on life's terms and kind of working program is a much better focus in terms of until you get some distance. You know, January of 2010 is a nice time period, but there's a lot. 6 months is a huge relapse period. 12 months is a big relapse period. 18 months is a potential relapse period. There are other things you need to be focused on right now, just making sure that you're living in a way that keeps you safe and keeps the marriage safe. And if you're going to Mark's thing, I think that'll be really good. Mark can give some good direction on that. Again, Mark is very good. Does my husband really love me? My husband had a severe emotional affair that lasted over 20 years in his mind after his affair partner moved away. Now he says he loves me and finally realizes that he didn't love her, that it was only an infatuation, that it didn't end. But when I ask him if he would still love me if I told her husband, who still doesn't know, or if I told someone and then without my knowledge that person contacted her husband and told him what happened, then would he still love me? He would not answer the question. After a few minutes of silence, I told him his non-answer told me he really didn't love me unconditionally, so I couldn't continue to be with him. Hours later, he said he would still love me, but said it in a very hateful voice. And this was after he had seen me cry or be upset, and I think he realized that this was the final bottom line for me and that I would probably not stay in the marriage. So does he really love me, or is he just trying to keep me in the marriage since he knows how his affair partner didn't really care for him? Does somebody really love you if they only love you if you can say and do what they want you to say and do? It seems that this conditional love is not the kind of marriage should be built on. I'm afraid his I love you is only words and not coming from his heart. Can you help me interpret what's going on here? Yeah, that's a very complicated one. And you know, honestly, I don't know that I can give you all the immediate answers. You know, those types of things, once someone gets into recovery and begins to gain perspective, sometimes I think you're way too close to the fire to really begin to see it, and there can be trauma wounds and all kinds of things at the core of this that it takes a long time for a person to gain perspective and really know what it was. We tend to believe our feelings, and one of the things I always say is that it only takes us 3 seconds to believe a feeling. It takes up to 6 years for us to take something that we learn, that we know, that we believe is true, or that we know is true, for it to actually move fully into our belief system where it becomes a part of who we are. So feelings get integrated much quicker than does what I would call truth. And if someone's had 20 years of an infatuation with someone, even though it's been an unrequited love, part of me would say that, you know, there's a huge grief point. There's a huge pain point, not grief point, but a huge pain point. And unless someone knows how to kind of walk through or work through that pain and kind of gain perspective, because whether it's a real loss, whether it was right, whether it was wrong, it doesn't change the fact that for them it may still be a point of something that their life rotated around. Again, it may be totally ridiculous, but it's still a loss that at one level they've got to deal with. And so the thought of some of that happening and then kind of blowing their world up, it takes time for them to get their mind around what that would look like and to even begin to get through the feelings to figure out ultimately what is important. And so in the moment that you're describing in this particular question, my concern is, could he actually even be objective and know kind of the answer to the question? Because I think it's probably scenarios that he hasn't looked at, and someone can actually know what they really want, but their feelings may not line up with it at first. And so that's where, if you've ever gone through any of our stuff, you may remember we did a thing called the truth triangle, and I can know the truth, but I still feel this. And that's what's really lousy, is that our feelings don't always line up with what we rationally know to be true. And so we end up in a huge internal conflict. And the scene that you're describing here to me really sounds like one of those situations where they've made a decision and they know, but they don't feel it. Their feelings haven't totally caught up to what they know yet, or they haven't even worked through all the feelings to get that worked through. And that, where that person would probably take some therapy. It might take some time to gain perspective, someone to process through that with. And it doesn't mean that they haven't in their heart, they know what they want. Again, every addict that chooses to not use alcohol or not use heroin or not use sex or not, you know, knows that the other person, it's not a good choice to go that direction. Part of what's incredibly vexing to them is the fact that they know what they really want, but it feels like they want something else. And so they have to live in the knowledge of what they know to be true rather than what they feel. Sometimes, I don't know if this helps any, if Stephanie asks me something and I don't feel like it, if I can kind of step back and process it and go underground and work my way through it, I can sit there and, you know, I can come to what I know that needs to happen. But it may still feel difficult in that process. So it sounds, again, that this is one of those things. You asked, does he really love me, or is he just trying to keep the marriage since he knows now his affair partner doesn't really care for him? I would say that, again, love isn't necessarily a feeling. That, in fact, giving up an illusion for you is potentially, I don't know in this case because I haven't talked directly to him, but potentially is a very, a huge act of love. Love is a choice, I think, far more than it is a feeling, and somebody who's had their feelings messed up for many, many years, it's a difficult thing that, you know, it takes a while for those feelings and all kinds of things for those feelings to ultimately come back to where they belong. If they've been off center for 20 years, you know, they're not going to come back in 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 months. It may take, you know, that, you know, we always say that as you begin that process, it may take 18 to 24 months. That's not just for the hurt spouse. Sometimes that's also for all of the issues to be worked through with the unfaithful spouse. They just need to be consistent in working through it. When I work with somebody that actually has had this sort of long-term relationship, an infatuation with another person, the way that we actually, that many years of thinking about it, what happens is the other person has been incredibly idealized. And so the vast majority of the therapy that I spend with people at that point is focusing on who that other person was, not their mate, the other person actually, and just processing through it so that they begin to gain perspective and can move beyond it. Because part of what gives it the power is the secrecy and the lies. Most people wouldn't be able to really do that with their mate. Don't think they need to be doing that with their mate. But, you know, there's a whole process that person's got to go through to fully get the feelings to realign with what they want in their heart. Because, again, feelings, they don't necessarily line up with the truth. That few minutes of silence, I wouldn't put a lot of stake in that. Some people are underground. Some people are above ground. Underground people really are going to always go back. And I don't know, maybe he is an above ground person. But typically underground people, before they're able to respond, have to go through and process. You know, I would also suggest, I don't know if y'all have a marriage therapist or anything, but it might be good to get a session with someone just to talk through things, because that's such a complicated question. And maybe who kind of understands this a little bit, and maybe there's some ways that, you know, someone can help interpret and help you both understand better what's going on in this situation. Because I said, like I said, 20 years of kind of an infatuation with someone, it's going to take months for all of that to kind of be understood, because I don't even know that he would fully understand it. And if he doesn't really fully understand it, it'd be really difficult for him to help you fully understand it. So don't give up hope on that one. I wouldn't, at least. 6 months ago, my husband accepted Christ and invested a one-night stand from several years ago. There was alcohol involved and no emotional involvement. We had only been married a year and a half, and were 22 years old, very selfish and immature. We argued a lot. He was not there for me emotionally, so in turn, I was not there for him physically. I realized our bad marriage made him vulnerable, but I was in the same bad marriage and didn't act out like that. Are men just weaker in these situations? He says he didn't think about the consequences, or me for that matter, because he was so overwhelmed and flattered when she approached him aggressively for sex. At a party, he was at alone because we were fighting. Like I had not been doing, and he could not resist. I would like to understand how an otherwise good man in a bad relationship could make such a devastating choice. So let's stop and answer that first question. So I want to first start with alcohol involved. Everybody needs to understand that when you use alcohol and ether is actually one of the initial the anesthesias they use to kind of put people to sleep. I mean, they may still use ether at times. It's not really good in an operating room because it's highly explosive. But alcohol puts the brain to sleep and the judgment center, the prefrontal cortex of the brain. So people will do things on alcohol that they would never do off of alcohol. Not that alcohol is an excuse by any way, shape, form, or manner. I'm just saying that, you know, the vulnerability factor is going to be higher. So you've got a high risk situation here, partially because you've got somebody who's been drinking, and so their inhibitions and it will be down, and their impulsivity will be up. You've also got a situation where they are disconnected from their mate because of what's been going on. Are men just weaker in these situations? If it's an issue where someone, men think about sex far more frequently. So there's a higher drive, ultimately. I call that a connection drive, not really a sex drive. They may not, but if they don't understand what it is, they're going to think it's a sex drive. So if they're feeling cut off, deprived, whatever, the one thing that's pinging through their head where they have a void of is going to be sex. A woman in the same situation where there's a huge disconnect may not be tempted at all by the sexual aspect, but if someone came up to her and just began to pay attention to her and told her how nice she was looking, may literally would tend probably to make more of an emotional connection, because that's far closer to where the deficit might be that she is feeling. And so part of the reason that, you know, it's not women unless they're kind of just like a man, or a man's just like a woman. Typically, the guy's going to go more with the in that whole drinking situation with the sexual piece, the woman would go more with kind of the emotional, temporary emotional involvement with another person. And those are huge stereotypes, so forgive me if I've stepped on anybody's toes. I'm not trying to be politically incorrect there. I would like to understand how an otherwise good man in a bad relationship can make such a devastating choice. Those are the reasons you've so far laid out that I think could be, you know, certainly your contributing factors. Also, in our recovery, we've noticed that some of our poor communication habits still exist from earlier in our marriage. How do we work on changing these without referring to my husband's infidelity that they contributed to? He says sometimes that I'm being judgmental, self-righteous, unforgiving because I have a tendency to bring it up a lot in our conversations. I've already forgiven him, or at least I thought so. How do I move on? My husband takes full responsibility for what he did and wants to start brand new the right way, but it seems like I'm the one hindering recovery. Help. Okay, so one of the things I would do, you need to find other ways to talk about it without using that as a reference point. I mean, because it's happening, if you're still doing it, it's happening real time. And you need to be talking about what's happening real time. If you go back and always bring up things from the past, that's called going historical. And it's, you want to kind of, again, you stay with your current moment. That's kind of fair fighting technique. Again, I'm not sure what's happening with y'all, but stay with your current event. If you've done the 911 course, or if you've done EMS, one of the things that we have is it's called Married for Life. And in the Married for Life course, there's actually much of it's focused on finding the raw spots and what are the negative communication patterns that couples get into that ultimately cause that disconnection, and how do you begin to break those cycles. Someone you might want to read, first off, getting a therapist to kind of help with communication techniques would be really good. If you could find somebody in the situation you're describing here, if you haven't done 911, that does emotionally focused therapy, a lot of times that's something that would be useful for someone in that type of situation. So I think, you just want to find a new technique. And one more thing here. Once you've processed kind of what happened back there, if you've forgiven somebody, then you typically don't continually, I mean, it doesn't even necessarily fully come to mind. But one of the things you might ask yourself is, if you've still got some pain that you really haven't healed from some of that, or maybe grieved, that would be my other concern, is that maybe you haven't grieved everything, and that's part of why it continues to come up, or there may be a little piece of trauma back at that place. But again, learning either through the Married for Life program or, again, emotionally focused therapy by Sue Johnson and somebody who's really good in that, or even Gottman, a Gottman certified therapist could really help you work through those issues. Next, this past week, my wife confessed to the second affair in 2 years. She's currently in the hospital under suicide watch. I'm at home with the kids. The last time I thought we could work things out, but obviously that didn't work. She's been diagnosed with depression, dysthymia disorder, general anxiety disorder, borderline and dependent personality disorders. She only scored a 2 or 3, not full-blown from what the doc said. I want to do this right, so I need to know the next step I need to take. I have asked a godly man who knows the situation to be my mentor, president of a Bible college just south of us. I have a support network of people. My church does not know everything, but it's helping. We're planning on coming to the next EMS seminar that you have, hopefully in May. My question is whether or not she should come home or stay somewhere else for a time. I want to work on this right now. I want to work on this but right now I don't want her anywhere close to me. This is incredibly hard to even take the kids to see her in the hospital. Any other advice would be greatly appreciated. Thank you. Wow. Okay. So you're in the middle of it right now. You know, my thought is the hospital should be helping. If she's inpatient right now in a hospital, that should be a definite part of the aftercare plan that is going to be covered before she is released. And if you're not comfortable with her being at home with you right now, I think that would certainly be understandable. And for that reason, I don't think you should necessarily feel badly about, you know, saying, you know, until we get through this weekend or whatever, I would, you know, I think it would be good for us to be, for you to be at another place. You know, I think it's, you know, unless the doctors somehow say that that's not a good thing, my concern would be if she came home to you right now and if she's already on suicide watch, that there's too much of a possibility that it would just be too hard to handle potentially. So if she could find a safe place until you could get to something like the EMS weekend, I think that'd be a really good idea. And again, the treatment plan, treatment team there at the hospital should be able to help you get that all worked out. And I do hope we're able to see you in May. Hopeful. My husband keeps asking me why I had an affair, and I have answers about what sent me into it, and the more I research myself, the deeper the answers become. The how question is a little harder to answer. How can you be with someone else and still love me? Why didn't you just leave? I tried to explain the feelings of desolation, if that's what it was, but he can't understand it. I was sexually abused as a child, and I've shared with him how it made me feel about love, protection for people who are supposed to love you, and how sometimes, and how something feels lost, and it isn't about sex. I try to explain how it was never about my affair partner, but it seems like he will never understand. I'm not happy. I just want to get to the deeper meaning about all of it. He thinks it sounds stupid, but I don't know, and I guess it kind of does. Any advice and insight and direction would be helpful. Thank you, and God bless. You know, the deeper answers to some of the whys and the hows and all of that, I think take literally years for people to understand. You know, getting into the childhood sexual abuse is going to be a huge piece. The problem is partly his problem, because there's not an answer, I think, that you're going to be able to give him that is going to be a satisfactory answer. And that's really one of the huge issues at this point. So even if, you know, you're able to tell him spot on all of the reasons as to how and why, that doesn't mean he would be able to accept it. Typically, when someone's looking for the why, what they want is an answer that ultimately would help the feeling or help the pain go away. And when I have somebody looking for answers, I mean, sometimes I'll just tell them, you know, I can probably come as close to guessing the why someone did something as anybody in the nation. However, I'm not going to give that to you because it's not going to change the course that ultimately you have to go through. You somehow think the answer will make it better and help it make sense. It won't make it better. What you have to go through in terms of the grieving is still going to be what you have to go through in terms of the grieving and the loss. The answers don't change that. And if you've ever been close to someone who died, I think you can understand that whole piece. I think it's good when a couple can come to a specific understanding that they're going to give themselves time to understand that answer. I think you can assure your husband that you're going to do everything within your power to answer that question, and you're committed to that. And as you go along that journey, if he wants to know, you can share it with him. But this is partially about his need to be able to come to grips with, you know, what has happened and kind of how it happened. The whys, again, may be really complicated and may take a while, so hopefully y'all will be able to find some page or some, you know, as you go through this and you study, you'll begin to find answers. But I don't know if the answers will help him to feel better, and whether or not he'll even accept it, because it may be, again, if you give him an answer and it doesn't make him feel better, he can't believe it, because, you know, he's somehow believing that the answer is going to make it better, and it just won't. So, but stay after your pursuits. I know it's a hard thing, and you'll be able to answer that question probably a lot better in a year. Telling your kids, last but not least, how and when do you tell your kids what's going on? We have a teenager on down to toddlers. What do you say? How much is too much or not enough? Probably I should answer this one starting next time, but I would just say it needs to be age specific. It needs to be relevant, kind of as a need to know in terms of their own recovery, their own kind of being able to understand what's going on. Hopefully it's something the two of you can do together. If it doesn't impact the kids at this point, then again, you've got to think, is it relevant to share the questions? Now, if there's a separation and some things like that, they're probably, we've actually got some other things on what to tell the kids written in the articles. I'm running out of time here on everything you ever wanted to know about infidelity. You might want to read that section. I think you can find that resource on the website. I'm just looking because our time's up here. But make sure that the kids need to know. And if they need to know, it's got to be very age specific, and that's talked about at length in that article. So with that, I want to thank everybody for joining the call today. Those were great questions today. I really appreciate it. And I hope everybody has a good week, and I look forward to talking to you guys next week. Thank you.